Now that the countdown is on for the presidential election, the ad wars are heating up. The Republicans already have had to yank one web ad attacking Barack Obama's use of the expression lipstick on a pig. And the Democrats have taken a shot, ridiculing John McCain for not knowing how many homes he owns. Political ads have come a long way from their earliest days on TV, when you would have seen jingles, cartoons, and crooners.
Madly love you, madly, and what you did for your own great state, you're gonna do for the rest of the 48.
You can trace the evolution of presidential TV ads on a website, The Living Room Candidate. It features political commercials from every presidential election since 1952, when those ads first started to appear. The curator of the site is David Schwartz of the Museum of the Moving Image, and he joined us from New York to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Let's begin with those early TV ads. How would you characterize them?
Those ads are just like jingles for products like soap and cereal and detergent. Rawson Reeves, who was the advertising man who created Dwight Eisenhower's campaign commercials, he was best known for creating slogans like M&M, melts in your mouth, not in your hands. So he knew that you could sell a candidate just like you can sell a product.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president,
hang out the banner, beat the drum. Washington.
These ads were innocent, sweet even.
Well, the original ads were very straightforward. It was just the candidate talking right to the camera many times. Dwight Eisenhower did a series of ads called Eisenhower Answers America, where he just answers questions from voters.
You know what things cost today. High prices are just driving me crazy.
Yes, my mamie gets after me about the high cost of living. It's another reason why I say it's time for a change.
If you look at how things were going in 1952, the cost of living was rising, and we were stuck in an unpopular war. So some things never do change.
Ads got a little more sophisticated, at least superficially, but it's interesting in 1960, the ads for John F. Kennedy were quite a bit snappier, and I mean just visually, than the ads for Richard Nixon. Let's play one of Kennedy.
You know, this is a very bouncy ad. We're seeing Kennedy posters bouncing around all over the place. And the Nixon campaign was all about experience and him being the seasoned, mature politician who knew what it took during the Cold War. So ads are really often not about the issues as much as being about a contrast in styles.
Well, even when Nixon was talking about the issues, it's just him sitting at the edge of a desk, no movement, just the camera staring at him and him talking right back to it.
I would like to talk to you for a moment about dollars and cents. Now, my opponents want to increase federal expenditures as much as $18 billion a year. How will they pay for it?
The message was this was a dangerous time and that you could not elect 43-year-old John F. Kennedy. Change versus experience, which we've been hearing a lot about this year.
At what point did ads change for good?
Ads really took a big change in 1964. There was a very kind of cutting-edge agency, Doyle Dane Birnbach, that was making conceptual kind of innovative ads. They did the Avis We Try Harder campaign. And when Johnson became the nominee for the Democratic Party, he decided to use the same agency. And they made most famous of all campaign ads, which is the Daisy Girl commercial. First you see this little girl, and she's picking petals off of a flower, and then we cut,
Five, four, three,
and there's a nuclear explosion and a mushroom cloud.
Zero.
Barry Goldwater is never even mentioned in the ad. If you're watching this commercial, you are just putting it together in your mind that if you vote for Goldwater, there could be a nuclear annihilation. The ad only aired one time as a paid commercial. Then it became a big news story, so all the networks replayed the ad over and over again. We saw that this year with the celebrity commercial that tried to link Obama with Britney Spears and Paris Hilton.
He's the biggest celebrity in the world. But is he ready to lead?
The interesting thing about the ad was it actually moved to the internet, where Paris Hilton created a faux ad to respond.
Hey, America, I'm Paris Hilton, and I'm a celebrity, too. And I want America to know that I'm, like, totally ready to lead.
I think that the internet is affecting the style of advertising. If you make a piece of video that people want to pass around and share because it's clever and provocative and kind of humorous, then it works on the internet. So I think we're seeing candidates trying to create ads that are much edgier and more provocative than they used to be.
One of the things that has been dominating news lately, of course, is the choice of Sarah Palin as vice president. There is a history of ads that question presidential choices. For instance, in 1968, when Richard Nixon chose Spiro Agnew.
So what we're seeing here is a TV set that just has the words Agnew for vice president, and we're hearing this voter laugh. Agnew was somebody who had been the county supervisor of Baltimore in 1962, and he quickly rose to becoming the governor of Maryland. So interestingly, he had about as much experience as Sarah Palin does today. And then there was an ad that the Dukakis campaign did in 1988, making fun of the idea of Dan Quayle being a heartbeat away from the presidency.
One in five American vice presidents has had to rise to the duties of commander-in-chief. For this job, after 5 months of reflection, George Bush made his personal choice, J. Danforth Quayle. Hopefully, we will never know how great a lapse of judgment that really was.
Now, these ads could be very compelling, except that they won.
Well, I think one of the things that amazes me is that every time there's a new ad that comes out, there was an ad from an earlier election that basically has the same exact message. Just like Hollywood loves to remake successful movies, political consultants like to remake successful commercials.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
David Schwartz is curator of the website The Living Room Candidate, which is run by the Museum of the Moving Image, and it's just launched the 2008 edition. See the TV ads you've just heard and lots more at our website, npr.org/elections. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne, and I've approved this story.
I'm Steve Inskeep, and this report is paid for by the Committee to Inform You.
This week on the show, our Autism Chronicles series followed the daily struggles of a single mom trying to raise her autistic son. Jennifer Hendrick heard the stories at her home in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and she sent us this.
Have you seen my son? He's the kid who bites or hits your kid in school, or in swimming lessons, or at the playground. He seems to do it for no reason. He may have even laughed inappropriately and then went on playing his own secret game. You probably asked him, why did you do that? Only to be told, I don't know, or I forget. What did you do? Did you scold him or me? Did you shoot me a dirty look, thinking I must be a terrible parent to have such an undisciplined kid? Did you walk away? You probably didn't notice that I rushed in to quiet the situation, that my eyes were on fire with embarrassment or swelling with tears. I'm a mother, too. I know. Your whole world is your child, and he was upset. The thing is, my son's behavior is not of his choosing, or the result of bad parenting. His behavior is because of his brain development, the brain of a child with Asperger's, or ADD, or any other variation of a child on the autism spectrum. He has trouble communicating and relating. He just doesn't get it. Sadly, there are times where I believe he even recognizes his own isolation and is fighting to get out. He wishes he could run and play with your child without getting confused, or last through a loud and crowded party without getting into trouble. I bet he even wishes that he had a best friend. As for me, I hear the whispers. I cringe with the knowledge that my son isn't like yours. I decline invitations to parties because I don't want to have those looks, or leave early, or have to reprimand him and protect him when I know that he is as uncomfortable as I am. I'm also exhausted. I'm sad. I'm often lonely, and I'm surprised. I didn't plan on having a son with special needs. My vision of parenting was of soccer games and neighborhood block parties. But now my challenge is to unlock the boy inside. He is a beautiful and wonderful gift. So I know you've seen my son, and when you see him in class, know he's doing his best. And when you see him at the playground, watch for him to interact as best as he can. When you see my son, realize that he is part of a bigger family, a bigger world, a much bigger plan. And when you see me, just smile and tell me it will be all right. For now, that's all I need.
That's one of our listeners, Jennifer Hendrick of Grand Rapids, Michigan. You can hear our Autism Chronicles series at our website. That's npr.org/day-to-day. And we'd like to hear from you, too.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin says she is ready to lead the country if needed. That statement came in an interview with ABC's Charles Gibson, who followed up.
And you didn't say to yourself, am I experienced enough? Am I ready? Do I know enough about international affairs? Will I feel comfortable enough on the national stage to do this?
You have to be wired in a way of being so committed to the mission that we're on, reform of this country and victory in the war. You can't blink. So I didn't blink then, even, when asked to run as his running mate.
John McCain's running mate. That was just the beginning of a conversation that ABC is spreading across 2 days of broadcasts. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik was watching, and he joins us. David, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So what did she say to back up the statement that she's ready?
Well, she talked about her experience as governor. She talked about work she had done in a variety of ways as a mayor, as a governor, thinking about issues for the people of Alaska, talking about common sense approaches to important issues. You know, both Governor Palin and Charlie Gibson of ABC News are being judged and watched very carefully. He for how fairly he's doing his job, and also for how tough he is in pressing for questions about this person seeking a high office, but also, you know, her, of course, for whether or not she's up for the job and whether she's ready. He plunged right into the questions of national security after asking about whether she felt she was qualified for the job. And specifically, he pressed her about, you know, the two things that the McCain campaign cited in saying that she was ready on national security issues. That's that her role as head of the Alaska National Guard and also Alaska's proximity to Russia. He asked the question a number of ways. She really gave the answer to a different question, ducking the questions he had asked, instead to tout her work on energy policy, saying, you know, the question of energy independence is really a matter of national security. So it was a very interesting deflection of the first thrust of the interview.
Well, you said that Gibson and Palin are being watched very carefully to be judged for how they did. Let's let people judge by playing a longer exchange of this interview. Charles Gibson here is asking about one of the major developments of the Bush administration, the so-called Bush Doctrine, which is a willingness to make preemptive attacks on other nations.
Do you agree with the Bush Doctrine?
In what respect, Charlie?
What do you interpret it to be?
His worldview?
No, the Bush Doctrine, enunciated September 2002, before the Iraq War.
I believe that what President Bush has attempted to do is rid this world of Islamic extremism, terrorists who are hell-bent on destroying our nation. There have been blunders along the way, though. There have been mistakes made. And with new leadership, and that's the beauty of American elections, of course, and democracy, is with new leadership comes opportunity to do things better.
The Bush Doctrine, as I understand it, is that we have the right of anticipatory self-defense, that we have the right to a preemptive strike against any other country that we think is going to attack us. Do you agree with that?
I agree that a president's job, when they swear in their oath to uphold our Constitution, their top priority is to defend the United States of America.
Sarah Palin on ABC News last night. David Folkenflik, you and I are just two citizens here. What did you learn from that exchange?
Well, it's tough. You know, look, you know, many people might not know that doctrine by its name. Certainly the Bush administration's willingness to do things unilaterally and preemptively is a pretty significant policy shift. Watching somebody aspiring to be vice president go through that give and take without a real sense of what the questioner is talking about, it's a real squirm-inducing moment for the viewer. And that's got to be a tough thing for Governor Palin. you know, she also was taking a pretty hard line. If you listen to the substance of what she was saying, she says the United States has a right to do whatever's necessary. And she followed that up with a fairly hard line toward Russia, you know, in terms of thinking about the degree to which the state of Georgia gets to be independent.
Just a couple of seconds here, but did she differ at all with John McCain on energy policy, which is seen as one of her qualifications for the job?
Well, she seemed much more at ease when she was talking a bit about as she's walking along the Alaska pipeline and talking a bit about whether she still supported drilling, which she has as governor, in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR. She said she hoped to bring the senator around to her position on that, that she's sticking to her guns.
David, thanks very much.
You bet.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and ABC is going to broadcast more of that Palin interview later today. International affairs are a springboard for the latest movie from Joel and Ethan Coen. They're fresh from their Best Picture Oscar for No Country for Old Men, featuring a psychotic killer and enough corpses to populate a couple of movies. Now they're back with a comedy called Burn After Reading. We have a review this morning from Kenneth Turan.
The Coen brothers have such a dark sensibility, someone ought to name a paint color after them. Forget Mustang Tan, Durango Dust, and Barleyfield Beige, and say hello to Coen Brothers Black. So even though Burn After Reading is a comedy, it's a Coen Brothers film before anything else. That means it's as bleak and hopeless as comedies are allowed to get before the laughter dies bitterly on your lips. Like any self-respecting spy movie, Burn After Reading begins at CIA headquarters. A veteran spook played by John Malkovich gets fired from the agency, so he starts writing his memoirs. His lame manuscript accidentally falls into the hands of two employees of a Hard Bodies fitness center, played by Brad Pitt and Frances McDormand. These bears of little brain think they have stumbled on raw intelligence data that can be sold to the highest bidder. A confrontation between an enraged Malkovich and a bemused Pitt shows how wrong they are.
Let me explain something to you.
What you're engaged in is blackmail. That is a felony, that's for starters.
I'm a mere good Samaritan.
Secondly, the unauthorized dissemination of classified material is a federal crime. If you ever carried out your proposed threat, you would experience such a storm of consequences, my friend, that your empty little head would be spinning faster than the wheels of your Schwinn bicycle back there.
You think that's a Schwinn?
Burn After Reading is as much a nightmare as it is a comedy, but it benefits from Frances McDormand's fine comic acting. She plays a woman who lusts after plastic surgery because, she says, I've gone as far as I can with this body. The messes she gets everyone into are so wacky that one exasperated CIA bigwig says, report back to me when it makes sense. That summarizes this archetypal Coen venture as well as anyone can.
Kenneth Turan reviews films for Morning Edition and for the Los Angeles Times. And we've got reviews of more new movies, including Alan Ball's Towelhead, at NPR.org.
Trailers can build buzz for a movie, but what can they do for books? Well, as Jesse Baker reports, the publishing industry is trying to find out.
This is not a film coming to a theater near you, but it sure sounds like it.
I'm going to ignore every other call. All the odd-numbered ones, starting with this one. Obvious, really.
And his wife is the boss of Pam.
She's one of those women that burns calories just by breathing. I should be jealous, really, but I can't be. I must be a very nice person. Chubby, but nice.
It's not promoting a movie. It's promoting Matt Beaumont's novel, Small World. Book trailers are tailor-made film shorts to lure potential readers into bookstores.
Movie trailers work for movies. Maybe I'll do something for books.
That's Sheila Clover. Clover can trace her roots in the book trailer industry back to 2002. Then, she was an aspiring writer looking for some way to make her book stand out. She thought, why not a book trailer?
When I first Googled the term back in 2002, it wasn't there. You know, there was nothing there, which is funny if you Google it now.
Clover saw an opportunity there and went for it. Her company, Circle of Seven Productions, is now one of many where authors and publishing houses commission trailers to market their work. Trailers are not meant to be cinematic versions of the books they advertise. More, they're an attempt to catch your eye and hopes you'll remember the author's name or at least the title of their book.
My name is Seth Greenland, and I've written a new novel called Shining City. It's set in Los Angeles, so naturally, it begins in a hot tub with a pimp and three hookers.
Book trailers have become standard operating procedure in the world of publishing, on display at publisher and retail websites, and of course, on YouTube. Lisa Gallagher is a senior vice president and publisher at William Morrow.
We're trying to put these videos in front of potential readers in the hope that they will be interested enough to pick up the book. And we really can't forget that's the ultimate goal.
So while you might see some of the more highly produced samples in a theater before a movie, you're most likely to find these trailers online.
I, Root Carbunculus, am invited to participate in the first magisterial treasure quest of Dreyan.
The publishing industry has seen the success of viral videos, and they're looking to get in on a little of that action themselves. In order to stand out from all the outrageous things on YouTube, authors have to make their videos pop. Again, Lisa Gallagher.
It means that our videos have to be compelling. They can't be, you know, they can't be poorly produced, otherwise there's no real point to doing them.
But not all trailers are compelling, and not all are authorized by authors or publishing companies. This trailer was made for a school project about The Catcher in the Rye.
See, that's the thing about girls. Every time they do something pretty, even if they're not much to look at, or even if they're sort of stupid, you always fall half in love with them.
Some trailers use a dramatic voiceover, but most rely on pulsating music and pretty fonts to push the books. Author Alexandra Sokoloff says she'll never try to market another book again without a trailer.
There's a certain audience, like the paranormal romance audience, expects a trailer at this point. They've seen them from their favorite authors and they expect to have a trailer so they can check out the book.
It's not only publishing companies and high school English teachers that are taking this seriously. Last year, Oscar-nominated director Alfonso Cuarón made a trailer for Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine.
And the best way to stay oriented, to resist shock, is to know what is happening to you and why.
For NPR News, I'm Jessie Baker.
And you can watch these book trailers at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. We have an exclusive report now on the Pentagon's efforts to go after Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the mountains of northwest Pakistan. NPR has learned that last week's raid by special operations forces into Pakistan from Afghanistan is part of a new intensified effort to go after terrorists between now and Election Day. NPR's Tom Bowman is with us. And Tom, tell us what you've learned.
Well, Melissa, government sources tell my colleague Tom Gelton and me that this is, again, part of an intensified effort to go after Osama bin Laden, other al-Qaeda leaders, and the Taliban in the northwest areas of Pakistan. And it's a three-phased operation. We just saw phase one, and they're going to keep going. And we're also hearing that they're pulling CIA operatives from around the world and focusing them on this area, including CIA paramilitary forces and also analysts.
What about members of Congress? Are they in the loop?
Well, members of Congress were told about this last week, just before the New York Times were ready to break a story about the raid into Pakistan. And there are some concerns on the Hill that this could have a political backlash effect in Pakistan. Now, the United States depends on Pakistan not only to go after some of these Taliban and al-Qaeda operatives in the Northwest Territories, but also for logistics into Afghanistan, moving supplies and fuel into Afghanistan. Pakistan is key on that, and they're worried that if you press too hard, if you have too many raids into Pakistan, they may balk at letting you take the equipment through Pakistan.
We're talking about a three-phase operation, intensified effort. Where is the authority for this coming from?
Well, the authority comes from the president. Now, he's already signed off on allowing the intelligence community to do this. And the intelligence community, the CIA, has been operating unmanned drones called Predators up in this area. And they've intensified the number of airstrikes from the Predator. And the Predator drops a 100-pound missile. And again, we'll see more CIA operatives up there, more analysts. And now the president has given authority for the military to go in. And we know that there's a SEAL team, Navy SEAL team, on standby in Afghanistan, ready to mount these kinds of missions.
And the raid into Pakistan was by Navy SEALs, I believe.
That's right. The raid into Pakistan last week was by Navy SEALs going after an al-Qaeda stronghold. And we're told as many as 20 were killed, although the Pakistani side said there were some civilians killed as well.
Tom, we mentioned the timing of this, and let's talk a bit more about that. I mean, we are 50-some days away from Election Day.
Well, some of the sources raise that question as well, that it's so close to the election. They think there may be a political element to this, a legacy building on the part of the Bush administration. And they ask the question, why wasn't more done over the past 7 years? So there's a real concern in some quarters that this is politically motivated.
Could be an October surprise.
It could be an October surprise or maybe even a September surprise.
NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, thanks very much.
You're welcome.